Okay, so it is soft. There was a tiny bit of spice. It's egg, white, with something spicy on top, like paprika or pepper or something.
Yeah, perfect. That's exactly what it was. It was egg with some paprika on top. I was looking on your website, and you do some work on sexual function. We were thinking about eggs and reproduction. Uh-huh. Eggs are things that develop, and cool. We're wondering, you know, try and tie something into your work.
I love it.
Hi, and welcome back to the Gastronauts Podcast. My name is Peter, and I'll be your host. Here at Gastronauts, we are committed to exploring communication throughout the body, with a particular focus on the crosstalk between gut and brain. We invite experts in this field to share both their research and their incredible journeys. So come join me as we explore the steps that go into shaping a scientist on the Gastronauts Podcast. Welcome back. Today we have Dr. Julia Kahlschmidt. Dr. Kahlschmidt is the Wu Tsai Neurosciences Institute faculty scholar and associate professor in the Department of Neurosurgery at Stanford Medical School. She received her undergraduate degree in molecular biology and biochemistry from the University of Madison, Wisconsin. She then completed her PhD at the University of Cambridge in the UK, where she trained as a developmental biologist and studied the cellular mechanisms underlying early Drosophila nervous system development in the laboratory of Dr. Andrea Brand. During her postdoc at Columbia University, she began working with a mouse as a model system and became interested in the mechanisms that underlie sensory motor circuit connectivity within the spinal cord. She continued to explore the development and molecular regulation of spinal circuitry as an assistant professor at the Sloan Kettering Institute in New York City. And during this time, the focus of her laboratory expanded to include neuronal circuits that underlie sexual function as well as gut motility. So I want you to tell us a little bit more about your research path. I'd love to hear especially some more about the transition from your PhD to your postdoctoral phases.
Ah, interesting. Okay, first of all, thank you for having me on this podcast. I'm very excited to be here. As you mentioned, during my PhD, I worked on fly development, particularly I looked at neuroblast development. And after my PhD on the search for postdocs, I was, to be very honest, I was very interested in gastrulation and was heavily invested into looking at labs that study gastrulation, but then decided to interview broadly. And I ended up interviewing at a lot of different places, all in the United States, and settled on Tom Jessel's lab at Columbia, where we studied spinal cord circuitry in mice. That, of course, is very different from gastrulation, but I was, I was very much interested in these questions of neurocircuit formation, which, of course, I had a window in during my PhD. And, you know, I was very attracted to Columbia, to the colleagues at Columbia, to the city of New York. So, yeah. It was a not straightforward path via gastrulation, but just to tell you, I thought very broadly. I was not exactly knowing what I wanted at that stage.
Yeah, and in retrospect, would you have done anything differently? Now thinking back upon the decision between going through...
Well, that's an interesting question. I think all the experiences that you have in life, they shape you, who you are. And I think from that perspective... I think it's very difficult to say I would have wanted to do something different because, you know, it sort of made me who I am. And to me, that's very valuable.
Yeah. So could you tell us a little bit more about some of the work that you did during your PhD?
So during my PhD, I worked on neuroblast development in Drosophila. And I took the approach of live imaging, which I think at the time was relatively novel. And so I had a GFP marker that would visualize the spindle. And what I noticed, and I remember actually the moment I noticed it still, that the position of the mitotic spindle rotates during this process of cell division in the neuroblast division. And I remember this moment because I printed out my data. It was late at night, and there was a postdoc in the lab, and I printed this out, and it was all fuzzy, right? I mean, the picture was, in retrospect, not ideal, but I printed it out, and I showed it to him, and I remember him saying, "Oh my God, do you know what you just found?" So I found that basically prior to the division, epithelial cells divide such that the determinants that are localized on one side of the cell get divided up into both cells equally.
So that the daughter cells can be similar.
Yeah. Okay. But for neuroblast, what happens is that the division is perpendicular, right? Such that the determinants go into only one of the daughter cells. And to mediate that, right, you have to have it's a 90-degree change in the axis of division. And so what I found is that the spindle gets assembled as if an epithelial cell would divide, but then during mitosis rotates 90 degrees, and then it's a quick flip, and then the cell divides in the perpendicular orientation. And this flip was what I...
What
my PhD was all about.
that's really cool. So I'm trying to visualize, what are the implications of this flip? Did you mention that the components of the cell are unevenly distributed after the flip?
Correct. So the components are, imagine, I wrote a review on this, and I tried to find a good analogy, and it's a piece of cake, right? So imagine you have chocolate cake with raspberry frosting and on top a raspberry or a cherry, whatever. And so usually you would divide, if you divide it right in the middle, both people get the same. However, if you would imagine cutting 90 degrees separate, then one person gets the cake and the other one gets the frosting and the cherry, right? And so that's the same for the neuroblasts. Yeah. So the GMC, the daughter cell, gets all of the components, which is different from the mother cell.
Yeah. And then understanding the mechanism of why, I guess, or how this neuroblast divides unequally. What are the implications for this, potentially?
Well, yeah, so then I went on to show that there was a mutant inscrutable that would not complete this flip and would divide at an angle. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, then means that the determinants are not anymore 100% unequally distributed, but sort of
somewhere in between.
In between. Even. And that has, a change or an implication for the cell fate of the cells.
Okay. And the cell fate and the determination of, I guess, the entire nervous system.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
In the development. Great. So for me, gastrulation is a huge process, right? All the organs are developing. Everything within the body is developing.
Yeah, right.
I know that you focused a bit on the nervous system in particular. Was there an emphasis on the spinal cord, or was the spinal cord something new that you had gotten interested in?
No, so the spinal cord was something new. To me, the spinal cord is really interesting because it has a direct link to motor output. So studying the circuits of an organ that has, you know, you can measure its effect directly on locomotion is exciting.
Yeah, for sure. And then the other thing was that you had previously done your work in Drosophila as a model system, and then you transitioned to the mouse.
Yeah.
Was there a thought that was going through your head? Were you thinking about, I want to work with the mouse model system from now on? Or tell us some of the pros and cons in your mind about working between these two model systems.
Yeah, to be honest, a very interesting question. I was curious about the mouse. And when I started doing my postdoc work, I very quickly realized that at the time, the tools that I was familiar with in Drosophila could not be translated to the mouse. And that was difficult to realize because it was basically, you know, I wanted to do X, Y, Z, and I couldn't do it because very limited in tools. So I think that was definitely a realization that I had. Of course, that's also exciting because you can generate the tools, right? So there's a pro for that. But coming from the fly in that sort of immediate wanting to do things space, that was a setback. But the other thing which, you asked me earlier on about the transition from PhD to postdoc, mice, of course, are more expensive, right? And if you think about, I took then the approach from postdoc to faculty, and I stayed in mice, that, of course, is expensive, right? I did not think about that at the time when I was choosing my postdoc, right? I didn't think about, this might influence my my expenses downstream.
Yeah.
But, some people might think about that. I didn't. But that clearly is a big difference.
So what exactly would you say the benefits of working in a mouse model system for what you're trying to study over within the Drosophila is very different studying gastrulation within the mouse versus the Drosophila, but studying spinal cord development is very different as well.
Right. So I think, you know, of course, the knowledge that we gain from understanding synaptic specificity in the spinal cord of mice ideally should be applicable to our understanding of human synaptic specificity, particularly in the realm of, you know, we are very interested in trying to understand what the molecular underpinnings are of the particular circuits. Mm-hmm. That knowledge should be beneficial for example, spinal cord injury and, you know, regrowth and reconnectivity of the axons. And it actually leads a little bit to my lab now studies, since our move to Stanford, has taken up a lot of studies of the gastrointestinal tract. And we have a project that basically links the spinal cord with the GI tract, because one of the comorbidities of spinal cord injury actually is colonic dysmotility. And we have a strong interest in trying to understand the interconnectivity of the spinal cord and the gut and, you know, how that might be disrupted or affected in spinal cord injury.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Completely different part of the body that you're studying the neurons within. I wanted to ask a little bit more about if you could describe your lab's vision or focus in a sentence or two, what would you say it is? Because the spinal cord is thought of as quite disparate or not really that connected with the gut until now.
So. Right. So, I mean, it's difficult to say that in one sentence.
Mm-hmm. Or as many sentences as you like. Just a brief idea what the vision of
Okay, so the vision, right, the vision is historically, we tried to gain a molecular understanding of synaptic specificity, particular of the inhibitory control of the sensory-motor reflex arc in the spinal cord. And more recent, we have come to take the approach of applying the tools and the knowledge that we have gained in the spinal cord to try to understand similar questions in the enteric nervous system, which is, again, trying to understand the circuitry of the enteric nervous system and an understanding of that, right? If we understand what particular cell types do, what's the effect of manipulating these on the, for example, on the paracelsus of the GI tract. And as I said, there's this one project which in the lab currently that connects both.
So could you give us a little bit more information for those who are not as familiar with how neurons develop specificity within synapses? How does one neuron within the brain or within the spinal cord decide to form a synapse with another neuron within the enteric nervous system? I know the process is very complex, but from a kind of 30,000-foot view, how do you view these connections?
So I do not know yet the answer to the spinal cord gut connection, but I can give you our insight on the sensory-motor or the GABAergic inhibition of the sensory-motor reflex arc. We know a lot more about that. I'll give you an example. So very briefly, just to describe the circuits, there are three important synapses. The sensory afferent terminal, which forms a contact on motor neurons. And then there's this GABAergic inhibitory neuron that forms a contact directly onto the sensory afferent terminal, okay? And we've asked, with these three units, we've asked questions about, you know, what mediates that specificity between the GABAergic neuron and the sensory afferent terminal? Why is it not forming a contact onto motor neurons? Mm-hmm. And so we found a adhesion molecule complex. Some parts of that complex are expressed on the sensory afferent terminal and another one on the GABA pre-terminal. And if we remove them from either one, we can see that the number of these GABA pre-terminals is reduced. So in this case, it's a sort of an adhesion molecule-mediated synapse.
And are these the three components that you think are necessary and sufficient, or do you think there are other components that perhaps may play a role in this?
Oh, I think there are other components as well. I mean, there's published data on positional identity. Yes, so I think the other question is, for example, we can't have a adhesion molecule for every particular synapse. That's different, right? So you have to think about different concentrations of different components. So there's definitely something else that's going on. Yeah.
So within this GABAergic interneuron, is the specificity the same with all sensory afferents?
Great question. So we do know a lot about the sensory-motor connectivity, mm-hmm. right? Because flexors and extensors have a very particular specificity. And we don't know very much about the GABAergic specificity, besides the fact, as I just said, that it forms contacts on sensory afferent terminals and not on motor neurons. And so, right, is it that you have a population that acts as an umbrella on every GABA pre-terminal, or do you actually have specific flexor versus extensor GABA pre-populations that might inhibit one versus the other. And that's exactly what one of the projects we're doing in the lab. I'm very excited about this one.
That's exciting. I can't wait to see what comes out of that.
Thanks for asking that question.
No problem. The other thing I'm wondering is whether or not this complex that you've seen, because we have GABAergic interneurons throughout our nervous system. Have you seen this complex anywhere else outside the spinal cord? Or have you looked in other locations at this point?
So we haven't looked, but it is in other systems in the brain, which makes it, of course, more applicable, right?
For sure. And then I guess the other thing that goes through my mind as I think of this relatively naively is before you can even form this connection, you have to get there. There's neurotrophins, molecules.
Right.
Do you have a good understanding of what the factors that are being secreted that bring these guys together are?
So again, great question. No, and you're right, right? So if you think about the process of synaptic specificity, there is, you can take it apart into different units. And one of the questions is, how does a cell know which target region or lamina to go to, right? And then once it reaches there, whether it can distinguish between different cell types, for example. The lamina specificity, or in this case, the regional specificity, which is closer to motor neuron cell bodies, we do not know what mediates that. We would love to know that. It's a process that happens in the first postnatal week. We know that. And we do know that if you remove this, via genetic strategy, get rid of the sensory endings closer to motor neurons, these GABAergic neurons will project ventrally into the spinal cord, but then retract. So they will not form a contact on anything else that is not sensory terminal. So they will not seek out an alternate target such as the motor neuron or another synapse.
Wow. So there's, in a sense, this active constant communication, right? Because if there's the sensory cell that's not there, maybe it's not receiving that signal, but at the same time, this neuron or this interneuron isn't really feeling motivated, I guess, if we want to anthropomorphize neurons towards that.
Yeah, see, we call this process stringent specificity, right? Because it's not seeking out an alternate synaptic binding partner. But the point being that it still grows ventrally, right? There is something that is not coming from the sensory afferent terminal because that's not there, that attracts the neuron to go there. And the question is what that is.
Yeah, so and presumably there's two different molecules, right? One that is involved in bringing it over and the other one that gives it that specificity or more,
two molecules, right? Yeah,
right?
You can think about two steps in that process at least.
Yeah, and is that stringent specificity, I guess, I am always wondering about generalizability of synaptic specificity, and I wondered whether that stringent specificity has been shown in other areas of the nervous system.
Not to my knowledge. So in the opposite of stringent specificity, which you could call hierarchical specificity, is shown in the fly, right? So you can think of the motor neurons innervating muscles, and also in C. elegans. I would say they are examples of hierarchical specificity. So I'd say no, not yet. How's that?
Yeah, I think that makes it interesting as to why it came about, right? I want to segue a bit more to another aspect of your lab. We talked briefly about the gut, but there was another aspect on sexual function.
Oh, yeah.
What drew you towards understanding sexual function from sexually specific sensory information and the spinal cord connections there?
Yeah, you know, it is on my lab website listed as an equal important project. We have at the moment no active research in the sexual circuitry, but we did. We actually see the sexual circuit as a alternate circuit to locomotion. It innervates differently in the spinal cord, and so we were using it as a sort of the yin-yang of trying to see how a different functional circuit, right? Very different function,
right,
how that synaptic specificity is guided or correlated with different function.
Okay. Can you walk me through a bit about the circuit? I guess I am not that familiar with the parts of it and all the moving components.
Right. So all we did basically is we injected into penile muscles. Mm-hmm. So the injection is a cholotoxin subunit B, which is our traditional injection, which we have injected before into hind limb muscles. Mm-hmm. What that does is it labels the motor neurons as well as the proprioceptive sensory afferent terminals. And so that's our way of labeling where cell bodies are and where the projections are.
So, yeah.
Basically, what we did is we injected into a couple of penile muscles. And what we notice is that the sensory afferent projections do not reach the locomotor muscles directly to the motor neurons. They're basically innervate the dorsal spinal cord. Mm-hmm. And we basically use that as a space for comparison because the proprioceptive, the locomotor, the muscle innervated, you know, we simplify it by saying, well, it forms a contact on a motor neuron, but it, of course, also has a dorsal branch, and that is in very close relationship to the penile muscle sensory branch. And so we had something that was close vicinity and comparable.
Okay. So in your view, correct me if I'm saying this incorrectly, you're using this other, I guess, motor system to study synaptic specificity, and it's, in a way, a different validation or a way to see whether a different mechanism of synaptic specificity is being involved.
Okay.
And then we had touched upon the gut aspect of it, and you had told me that this is something that you're very interested in, but could you tell me about some of the work that has been done to show this connection between the two?
So as I said, we are new to the field of the gut. This came about also, and I did elaborate on the fact that this came about because of spinal cord injury, right? It actually came through one of the seminars in the neurosurgery department. I learned that there was this really strong sort of comorbidity of gut dysmotility. And so we looked closer, and there is not a great understanding of what the interconnectivity is between the colon and the spinal cord. Is there one, right? I mean, there's clearly a textbook suggestion that there is connectivity via, you know, sensory neurons going from the colon to the spinal cord and via postganglionic neurons going to the gut. But we, and so primarily we were interested in mapping the sensory innervation. And so we basically injected CTB into the colon to see what we see. That has revealed quite some interesting connectivity aspects.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because I think one of the things that our laboratory really talks about is this connection, this drive to find food, right? This motivation to eat. It would be interesting in my mind to see whether there's this, whether A, the architecture is there that's present, and then B, can we modulate this architecture?
Yes, and right, for us, the way I think about this is that, you know, is there an architecture slash a, maybe an architecture that's there that we can use to drive peristalsis, right, via the spinal cord.
And then the other thing that comes to my mind is you were mentioning this comorbidity associated with people who have spinal cord injury and colonic dysmotility. I wonder whether or not people who have colonic dysmotility are more susceptible to developing spine injuries.
I don't know whether it is, whether I would think about it that way around. I may think about it the other way around, right? Because you've interrupted the spinal circuit because there is an interconnectivity. We are disrupting somehow the motor function. And you're right, there are other, you know, besides spinal cord injury, there is Parkinson's disease, there's autism, all of those have GI dysmotility phenotypes, right? And the question is why? I think it has a lot to do with actually the enteric neurons themselves. One question in the lab is whether, you know, autism-associated genes are expressed in the enteric nervous system.
I think that's reasonable. It's just, I guess my thought is whether or not this pathway has the potential to be bidirectional.
I see what you mean. Possibly.
Exciting. It's an exciting avenue. I feel like there's a lot out there for us to figure out. And then the other thing that comes to mind is there a way to tie together the synaptic specificity between these different motor circuits like erectile function with this gut motility? Is there like any way to tie all these circuits together?
So that I don't know. But, you know, actually, if you look at spinal cord injury comorbidities that are listed by patients as wanting to be corrected or suffering most, it is first colonic dysmotility, then it's sexual function, and then it's limb function. So sexual function is clearly also affected. I do not know to what extent there is a link, right? But both circuits could be going through the spinal cord.
I think intuitively it makes sense that they both are going, but understanding, I guess, the specificity of how these circuits map, very interesting. Ask a bit more about some of your writing, actually. So I noticed that you had recently published a preview in Neuron titled Chandelier Cells Swipe Right for L1
Cam.
And I thought the title was very interesting, right? I think it really draws the attention of people who are in kind of modern day society looking at their apps and swiping left or right all the time. Why do you think the titles for previews and news and views are so different from the titles in actual articles?
Interesting. So first of all, I need to credit my postdoc, Ryan Hamnett, for that title. Mm-hmm. He's the first author of this preview and is a spectacular writer. Each time I write a preview, I think I feel challenged to come up with a title that is sort of fun, has a second meaning, makes people think. I think it's there are no real restrictions to that. Mm. I personally think that a title for a paper should be very precise. I think every word in that title should be visualized in the paper. So, right, so when I read the title, I would love to see that reflected in the paper. It's almost like a mini summary, you know? Yeah. Why that is, maybe traditionally so, right? I mean, maybe because it doesn't allow for overstatements, right? Being precise.
Yeah. And then I guess what you had just mentioned made me think of these graphical abstracts that certain journals have. What do you think the value of a graphical abstract is if your title should give you that evocative image?
Yeah. Well, you know, I personally love graphical abstracts. I do spend a lot of time making graphical abstracts. I once taught a class where I also, that was one of the assignments, doing a graphical abstract. You're right, that might seem a double effort to summarize a paper. However, I think it has different values. I'm personally a very visual person. So I look at this graphical abstract and I really get a lot of information out of that. So I think it is perfectly valuable to have both. You know, the graphical abstract, I think, can include more content. Maybe more detail.
Right. So one of the principles that you had mentioned for your title is that it should give you a very precise, specific image of what is to come in the paper.
Yeah, right.
With regards to creating an image that summarizes your entire paper, are there any principles that you focus on or follow?
So as I said, I'm a very visual person. I was actually accepted to art school originally. And so I had to make this decision between art and science. And I think it has influenced how I make figures for a paper and how I, you know, we have our confocal in the lab and I love imaging and it's a very important aspect in our lab.
We have beautiful images on your website.
Thank you. So it's very important to me. When I think about a graphical abstract, I think trying to make it in a sort of minimalistic style, which still represents the message, I think is essential. I've done graphical abstracts and I, you know, generally I have too much stuff in my graphical abstract at first. And then I think the challenge is to make it clear, to sort of minimalize, to sort of conceptualize. I think that's a challenge. I think it's not easy to make a graphical abstract, actually, a good one. But I think it's good also for the person who makes it because you really have to think about
the most important
things in your paper.
Interesting. One other question that I wanted to ask was, I saw that you are a co-editor-in-chief for the journal Neural Development.
That's correct.
Can you tell us a bit more about this position and why you chose to pursue it?
You're right. So I'm a co-editor-in-chief for Neural Development. There are lots of reasons why I think this is an important position. First, I want to say I have really amazing co-editors. It's wonderful to work as a team. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at my research, we do molecular neurobiology. If you look at the history of molecular neurobiology, I think it's an important field that is very important to be continued. And of course, you know, we have functional data that are added and very valuable additional information.
Right.
Neural Development is a very, I'd say, traditional journal, which focuses on neural development. As such, it is very important to me that it continues to get the attention as a research field. When I was invited to be co-editor, I said yes, because I think it is an interesting challenge in nowadays time to keep that research field sort of on the radar of our minds.
Yeah. You had mentioned molecular neuroscience as being a classic field. I think of, at least in my neurobiology course, this discrete between molecular neuroscience and systems neuroscience, which has gotten very popular.
Right.
Why do you think molecular neuroscience is important for neural development?
I want to make clear that, you know, I think all the other fields are very important too, right?
Certainly.
But at the end, right, if we understand how something functions, right, and we understand the systems biology, at the end, I think it is very important to know how these connections are made, right? Mm-hmm. To me, it is important to know, you know, what are the molecules or the mechanisms or sort of the rules that make particular synapses. Personally, to me, that is sort of the essence of a synaptic circuit, right? How does it interconnect? And so it's almost looking at, rather than looking at a bigger entity or building, it's trying to look at, you know, how does the brick fit in the wall next to the other brick?
Yeah, works. Certainly. I think what I'm hearing is you really like to zoom in to see there's this huge system that's going on. We can only study it if we study it piece by piece.
Yeah,
and what you're interested in is that really the glue that holds the bricks together.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's a difficult word, glue, actually, because glue oftentimes to me means, it does mean specificity, right? So you have to imagine a glue that only glues certain parts.
Yeah, it's like a lock and key, maybe. More specific.
Sorry,
like,
this is
right?
Exactly what it is, right? It's a lock and key.
Yeah,
you're right.
I think that's the classic image that people think
absolutely.
Of. But yeah,
yes,
really neat. Well, I want to thank you so much for your insights and your time.
Yes, it was fun. Thank you.
Dr. Kalschmidt walked us through some of her scientific work on what exactly are the molecules, mechanisms, and rules that allow neurons to make connections with one another. And along the way, we learned about how she thinks about working with a particular model organism, as well as the importance of being precise with our language, and especially in our titles. And with that, I want to thank you all so much for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode. For more of our content, you can follow us on Twitter at GutBrains or visit our website at thinkgastronauts.com. The Gastronauts podcast would be impossible without our incredible team. Meredith Schmell is our producer and theme music composer, and special thanks to the founders of Gastronauts, Dr. Diego Borquez and the Borquez Laboratory.